I'm very excited about the prospects for today, and I just want to jump right into it by introducing our guests to you one by one. First, Wayne. This is Wayne Marshall. Wayne, tell us what you do.
I'm an ethnomusicologist.
Say it slower.
So it rolls off the tongue a little too quickly these days. Ethnomusicologist. Some of us would like to drop that prefix and just be musicologists, but traditionally musicology has referred to the study of Western European art music, and ethnomusicology was sort of an anthropological reaction to that wanted to look at music much more broadly in human society. So it's the study of music in the context of culture and society.
So there are actually schools where you do this? I mean, this is a legitimate profession?
Harvard University has its own music department with an ethnomusicology department within that, and some distinguished scholars.
And where are you now?
I'm currently at the University of Chicago.
And what are you doing there?
I've got a postdoctoral fellowship, and I'm teaching some classes and otherwise writing articles and doing other sorts of research.
And are you a musician yourself?
I'm also a musician, I guess. People usually ask me what my main instrument is, and I say laptop. and my musicianship tends to be in the digital realm and tends to consist of sometimes synthesizing and recording and sampling my own things, but other times manipulating other people's music, large chunks of other people's musics, and usually because I'm an ethnomusicologist and can't quite take that hat off either, with a kind of pedagogical purpose or some sort of critical intent in the way that I bring them together. But so I also DJ, but I click instead of spin, and I also sometimes rap a little bit.
Let me take those one at a time. You DJ. Are you doing any DJing these days?
I'm doing DJing this day, tonight, at the Enormous Room in Cambridge, doing a little set with my friends who run a night called Beat Research, which is appropriate for Boston, sort of a quasi-intellectually, conceived night, but it's usually about playing all sorts of... It's a very eclectic night, and it's about sort of seeing the way that different genres relate to each other and that sort of thing.
And so what do you play when you play?
Well, a variety of things. I suppose it depends on the venue, the context, whether people are going to be dancing or just listening, whether I have a particular sort of thematic thread I'd like to weave, whether I want to draw attention to the ways that particular genres relate to each other or styles cohere or melodies migrate.
So it's not your own music that you're playing?
No, I guess not, although oftentimes I'm manipulating it to greater or lesser extent, depending on what I'm going for.
So you take other people's music?
Yes, music that's been produced by other people.
Without permission?
Typically, yes.
And mix it up and mash it up and make a work of art of yours?
Yeah, and often just for a particular live performance, but also increasingly I like to share these things on the internet, usually with a fair amount of critical text commentary to sort of explicate why I'm doing what I'm doing.
And you're part of a group of people that do this.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, a looser group and a smaller group. I have a smaller group of cohorts, including DJ C and DJ Flack, who do the thing on Monday nights. And we call ourselves the Rhythm Method, which refers to the Jamaican rhythm system, which is a system itself that's very much about taking other people's music and sort of redoing it. And, of course, it has that pun going for it, too. But the method is an important part, too, because I often feel that, as an ethnomusicologist, a lot of the ideas I'm trying to express are better expressed audibly, orally, than, through however effectively I might be able to craft my prose or chart certain things. So.
And you are playing tonight at the Enormous Room. What's the address and what's the time?
The Enormous Room, I think it's 567 Mass Ave or something like that. It's upstairs from Central Kitchen, right next to the T-stop. They usually go from about 10 to 1, and I'll be playing somewhere in the middle of that. I'm not sure exactly when.
Okay, and now you also write about music.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I write about music for academic publications, peer-reviewed journals, that sort of thing. I also write about music occasionally, sort of freelance journalism. Usually I'm invited by one publication or another to write. And those invitations have largely come as a result of my blogging activity, which is something I just... Actually, something I started doing when I was doing field research down in Jamaica and wanted to be able to keep not just a record for myself, but something of a public record to express the things that I was learning and grappling with while I was down there. And I've sort of continued with that, often Jamaica-centric or Caribbean-centric or, you know, related to my research, but open to other things as well. So publishing in a variety of venues and voices.
Hmm. And you say you're a rapper. Are you a freestyle rapper?
Well, I used to be a better freestyle rapper. You have to sort of keep that practice up, you know, to keep the skills sharp. But I've been known to freestyle once or twice. Did a little bit last night.
So you're current.
Well, it was, you know, I'd say it was a rusty performance, but not bad considering how long it had been.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I suppose I'd be putting you too much on the spot now if I asked you to sort of stand up and just do a little freestyle rap.
You would be putting me on the spot, yeah. I could try. Let me see. You throw out a challenge, so let me try for one. I'll try to be live. You can tell me if I'm the live one. Maybe I can get up, do a little thing like Iverson, or maybe I'll just sit down and play my role in Cyber One.
Now, Mike, tell us about you. What's your job?
This sounds like a lot more fun. I'm general counsel at Viacom.
Just give us a sense of Viacom. I know we've all heard of it, but what is Viacom?
Today, Viacom is principally a cable programming company, internet programming company. A lot of our brands you've heard of, MTV, VH1, Nickelodeon, Spike, Country Music Television, various other networks in the United States and around the world. Recently, a lot of internet properties are things that we own. iFilm, Adam Shockwave, Addicting Films, Xfire, which is a communications company that lets people communicate when they play video games. A video game company called Harmonix, which makes something called Guitar Hero that lets people play guitar while on their video game on a Sony PlayStation. We're also in the movie business. We own Paramount Pictures, and ways that those companies go together. So that's principally what we do.
And what do you do as general counsel? You are the general counsel of Viacom.
The general counsel.
What does the general counsel of Viacom actually do?
You know, my boss asks me that same question every day.
Who is your boss?
I report to the CEO, to Philippe Domon, who's the CEO. Until recently, Sumner Redstone was CEO. And he is now chairman. What do I do? My principal job in life is advising the board of directors and advising the CEO on all manner of legal issues and business qua legal issues affecting the company. So I spend a lot of time on board issues, board governance, things that are purely corporate stuff, financial transactions, bank financing, securities law, issuing public reports to the, you know, 10-Ks and 10-Qs and other public reports to shareholders. And then a fair bit of my time is spent on both disputes affecting the company and kind of policy issues where law is a significant component. So copyright, which is really our principal business, ends up being an area where we spend a lot of our time thinking about how to enforce copyright issues, how to enforce our rights, how to ensure that we get the value our shareholders expect out of the investment we make in copyright in various ways. So
you've been part of the copyright contentious scene.
For a long time, yeah. The movie and cable television industries were a little later in the game than the music companies, which had, you know, as bandwidth expanded, the music companies got... are much smaller files, so they obviously were affected much more quickly than we were. But we have been, you know, we've had digital businesses as long as I've been at Viacom, which is, 13 years now. So experimented with things. We had Viacom Online, and I remember, we looked at buying Yahoo back when Yahoo was a startup. And, you know, it's been a part of what we do and think about has always been. And in some ways, we're a technology company. You know, we think of ourselves, cable, when Viacom started, when MTV Network started, cable was an experimental technology, and we were one of the very, very first channels that was ever launched, and technology's kind of always been a significant component of what the company does.
You work on deals.
I work on lots of deals.
Like, give me a sense of what's the biggest deal you ever worked on?
The biggest deal I ever worked on closed December 31st. It was the split up of Viacom into two pieces, CBS Corporation and Viacom. So we took a company that was about $65 billion in market capitalization and created two brand new companies out of it.
Okay, so here's why I'm excited. I actually know both of these folks, you know, pretty well. Wayne is my son-in-law. He's married to Rebecca. And he and I have traveled to Jamaica, and we know each other very well. And Mike is friend of a friend, but through best friends, and we've spent time in summer places. And these are both really genuinely decent human beings, right? But they're on two sides of a gulf. Just to introduce, Wayne brought home just recently a copy of a book put out, what's the name of it, Da Capo, called It's the Best Music Writing of 2006. And he's been included in this grouping of best music writers. Quite wonderful. He pointed me to the lead piece in this, absolutely fabulous piece, about Bob Dylan's greatest protest song. People know the name of Bob Dylan's greatest protest song? What do you say?
Hurricane.
Nope.
The times are changing?
Times are changing? Nope. It's called Masters of War. Masters of War. Wayne, can you tell us a little bit about Masters of War? Why is it such a powerful song, and why is it considered the greatest Dylan protest song?
It's a Grail Marcus piece, we should say, first off. And what's interesting about the way he writes about it is he talks about it as a bad piece of music that ends up being very effective and very powerful. And that sort of draws us into what makes it a great protest song. It's a very... it's a song in very strong language. I'm not going to recall a lot of the lyrics at the moment, but it's, you know, the sort of I hope that you die and I'll stand over your grave until you're dead. And it's a very, you know, you masters of war, you who are selling the weapons of war.
Come, you masters of war, you that build all the guns, you that build the death planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, I just want you to know I can see through your masks. And it goes on through numbers of verses until it gets down to toward the end here. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. Oh, I should... The verse before, let me include it before I go to the end. How much do I know to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say that I'm unlearned. But there is one thing I know, though I'm younger than you, even Jesus would never forgive what you do. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I will follow your casket in the pale afternoon, and I'll watch while you're lowered down into your deathbed, and I'll stand o'er your grave till I'm sure that you're dead. All right, that's a pretty tough song. All right, so here, in one sense, we have this copyright divide. On the one hand, there is, well, how would you put it at the extreme? I think of it as the pig and the pirate. That's the way Dylan would put it. And it's a gulf on which each side has used rhetoric that is very high. And if it's any thesis of mine, it's that just this attitude is what made the 60s fail. This idea of protest, where The idea is to beat the other person in such an oppositional form that you stand over their grave and make sure they're dead is just exactly the form of oppositional argument against which I would set the empathic approach that I'm interested and Beck is interested in seeing us explore here. So what excites me about today is the possibility of having two people who I know to be excellent, wonderful people talk about an issue where there's a huge gap in between, and to do it as much as possible, and I challenge each of them to do it as much as possible, in a way that is empathic to the other side. And what I'd like to do is ask Mike and then ask Wayne to talk to the other and then have us as a class kind of get into it and see if we can coach in the direction of finding empathic ground and articulating it. So, Mike, turn and talk to Wayne. Would you see if you can persuade him that your way of looking at things is the right way? See if you can connect with this guy.
All right. Well, I guess I would start out by questioning your premise of the beginning, which is, did the 60s fail? You know, and I think that the strong language of Dylan was not a failure, but I think it became, it made a loud noise and began to become integrated into the mainstream. And I think if you look at various periods in American history where there were huge divides, North and South, socialism and capitalism, various others of the major debates that have really shaped things. And in some ways, copyright is a very important one, but not as major as the war, the life and death ones that you lay out or some of these others. You know, much of the good that came out of, you know, the strikes and the firebombs of the turn of the last century became embodied in fair labor laws, became embodied in you know, lots of positive changes as the rough edges kind of got softened out, and the pieces that work and the pieces that don't work got figured out, and then but I think people didn't abandon communism; it just became socially integrated into the mainstream. And I think that that's true about the 60s. I think the good parts of the failures that were being pointed out by the radicals of the 60s. The rough edges got sorted out, and I think a lot of what people began to realize, race relations became mainstream. You know, even the anti-war discussions of the 60s, I think, became much more a part of what people talk about. And now I think in copyright, you're beginning to see the same thing. And I think where, at least the people who are on the forward edges of this, where I think 10 years ago, there was just complete opposition. Copyright was a bad thing. It should be abandoned. That basically, anytime somebody does work, it should be generated by the millions and should be posted for free. And that should be, the world would be a wonderful place because everybody was creating all this stuff for free and doing it in their spare time and I guess earning their livings doing something else. That was the idealistic world. And I think that people are beginning to realize that you know, there should be a way to, you know, people should be able to make a living doing what you do, and people should make a living creating songs, and people should make a living writing, and that if they find huge audiences, that there should be a reward for that. That's not just a reward of knowing you found a huge audience, but also a reward that's financial. You should live on it. You should be able to do things like that, and that means a certain degree of copyright protection. At the same time, I also think the copyright industries, which we were talking at lunch about monopoly and about somebody who did something very interesting with the monopoly concept and how Parker Brothers just basically said, you know, you're using monopoly, don't touch, stay away. I think our companies have begun to get more sophisticated, which is that people who, that what we call Web 2.0, the user-generated additions, adoptions, changes, some of it's completely user-generated, far more of it is transformative in some way of the things that we do. That it's a it is a way for us to make money, you know, which is after all what we're about, but also a way of expanding the influence of what we make and the role and the visibility of it. And I think that now Hopefully the people who are at the forward edge of this are beginning to see that there is kind of more common ground and trying to take those rough edges off and figure that both of what, you know, the anti-copyright folks are saying is beginning to be integrated in our thinking. You know, it's a bad idea, I think, in some of these cases. You know, Larry Lessig in his book talks about, you know, uses as examples both telephone companies trying to do very consumer-unfriendly things to kind of protect their monopoly, but also he talks a lot about copyright companies that have been over the top. They've taken what is really kind of as a business matter anyway, an unprincipled decision to kind of establish a legal point of view, and have begun to move. You know, we've tried to avoid those situations. We don't want the faux pas of, you know, suing somebody who, you know, is not a, you know, engaged pirate, if you will, but somebody who's, you know, kind of an ancillary way, trying to use a product in a way that's not, you know, really in any significant way destructive. Mm-hmm. And so I do think there's that integration going on right now, which may make your class a little less controversial, but I'm sure we'll find points of controversy.
Yeah, shall I respond? I mean, I find a lot of that promising in certain ways. I mean, as we were also discussing at lunch, the recent deals that YouTube has been striking with various content companies to allow people who upload videos, whether they're dancing to a song or karaoke sort of versions of it, or maybe something even more transformative, to be able to sort of account for that and let people go on doing what they do with digital media, which seems like a really productive, almost explosive, creative sort of thing, without cutting down on it too much. So using, in a sense, the middleman here as YouTube to regulate that. And that seems promising to me, too. I guess the other thing we were talking about at lunch, though, is to what extent does that still end up putting such a burden of risk on the creative end of things, so that one really has to put oneself out there, put one's work and labor out there in a way that may or may not be approved by the powers that be. And I see this in terms of the mashup sphere of things, but also in hip hop and reggae and lots of sort of electronic musics that, because music making software has become so widely available, has really democratized access to the tools of production in a way that wasn't formerly there, and has created a lot of productivity, which then has to have these certain filters, different, maybe new filters than the previous ones that would enable someone to end up on MTV or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I also see it in scholarship, where someone like myself, who wants to either express my ideas with the very media that I'm talking about, or even to try to write a paper that quotes lyrics or that has a transcription of some musical passage. Right, currently the constraints, because the publishing industry is very, very tentative, very cautious about what they put out, the constraints end up being such that I'm discouraged from even doing that sort of thing, which I find really, really compromises the kind of work that I can do and the way that I can communicate it. So I still see, despite these sort of promising, maybe concessions, but maybe they're not exactly concessions, because the content industry sees them as gains of ways of finding a new revenue stream that actually taps into this Web 2.0 creativity. I still feel like there's a chilling effect on the one hand, and there's also just a grand sort of power imbalance, so that the individuals or the small-time groups are still in this situation where they could get hammered by the C&D at any time. Mm-hmm. And so it seems very... I'm not sure how optimistic to be about it. And again, when we come back to the idea of integrating the radicalism of the 60s, the Masters of War are still very much making their money selling bombs and guns. Racism is not anywhere near resolved, especially, you know, certainly in this country. To some extent, I mean, we've seen certain ways that socialistic reforms have been incorporated into government policy, but, you know, one could argue that the capitalists have won that that battle as well. So, I guess that's where I end up coming down on the cynical side of this chasm, although I have been enheartened by recent embraces of, you know, this sort of democratized access to production and circulation on the part of...
Yeah, well, I think in a perfect world, if we had all the resources we needed to kind of sit and look at the stuff that was, you know, being put in your book, I would think... And the people who had good judgment inside the companies, right? Some of the stuff is structural, big company stuff.
Right.
People would look at what you're talking about and say, this is great, right? I mean, I think some of the problems that we're dealing with are big structures that are built up around different systems that haven't changed quickly enough. At one time, you know, we are on the power front. I think the democratization that you're talking about translates over to the rights issues itself. If you're a small singer-songwriter who has an audience that maybe is not mainstream, but might be geographically dispersed worldwide, even different demographics, the technology and the rights that we talk about are an empowering thing. You can decide with your song to make snippets available to the world, or clips, or lyrics. Make your performances available in a way that people can transact with you, even when you don't have the ability to, you know, get a million copies of a CD into every record store or onto iTunes or wherever it is.
Right.
The technology and frankly, a strong version of copyright can be a very empowering tool to the little guy, and particularly in the song area where ASCAP and BMI kind of look out for the interests of songwriters. Record companies are a different beast, but record companies have a kind of a complicated thing where their size enables them to get a big piece of the pie as a licensor. But I know there are a lot of people who don't feel that they necessarily, because of their size, share that appropriately with people who participate in the creation of the music that they distribute. Mm-hmm. And I think that those size issues are a big deal. I do think there are a lot of places in the market, there are market power imbalances that work against both creators and consumers, and in many cases even companies like ours. There are a lot of markets where we feel like the little guy. You know, for us trying to get rights out of Universal, for example, you just saw Microsoft just did a deal where they're going to pay Universal for every one of their Zune players, the new music players that they're coming out with.
Tell people about Universal so they understand what you're
talking about. Well, Universal is the biggest music company in the world. And they're in the process now of buying, I think, the third or fourth largest music publishing company, which would add to their own music publishing business and make them by far the biggest music company in the world. And what a record company does, you know, as you know, they put out CDs and they publish songs. They do deals with songwriters. Their principal business is doing deals with songwriters and then licensing out the rights and slicing them in ever thinner slices to make sure they can capture as much of the money from those things as they can. So they, they'll license, for example, to a musical recording for somebody to have an internet radio station, just on a compulsory basis. Somebody to have a download service like iTunes, they'll license the performance there and figure out what the deal is with Apple and split that up. Their music publishing businesses, although it sounds like, you know, printing scores, which it is, biggest part of their business is. Is taking the rights that the songwriters own and exploiting those rights. So the songwriter gets paid every time a CD gets made or a song gets downloaded from iTunes or is attached to a movie or is attached to a television show or is in a music video. Their job is to make sure that they negotiate the best possible deal for the songwriters as part of that. Collectively, this company will control more than half of the music that exists, and they come to a company like ours, and we want to make a television show, and it's got a Universal song in it, it's very hard. The deal I was just talking about with Microsoft is they've agreed to pay Universal, I think it's $1 on every Zune that gets made, whether it has any Universal music on it at all. And the what we're hearing is that they're going to go after Apple next and say, you know, there's all this stuff that's not licensed on iPods, and we just want you to pay us it every time you sell an iPod because it's really what the value of the iPod is the music that's on it. I think that there are people who aggregate large amounts of market power in the space. And it's not usually a single singer-songwriter. It is some, in some cases, these companies that have managed to put a lot of rights together. And I think that when the market functions well, that you get to a nice balance between users and consumers really drive it. And although there are imperfections from time to time, ultimately, in a big way, what consumers want to do is what drives our companies to deliver it. That's how we make money, and the markets kind of deliver what people want to be delivered. I do think that there are areas where market power is in imbalance from time to time, and that would suggest that, to my mind, not that there's a problem with copyright, because markets get imbalanced in oil and all kinds of other things, but that if there is a regulatory hand, it's about how to make those markets more effective and more competitive.
Okay. I mean, one response, I guess it seems to me that the model of the singer-songwriter still upholds a fairly traditional, if not romantic, notion of how music is made today, right? So it's still this person who came up, plucked these notes out of the air and came up with an original melody and an original seating for it. And of course, that's never been the case. Bob Dylan's Masters of War is based on an old English, you know, folk song. And we might compare that sort of, that same thing, which the songwriting industry was able to resolve in its own way, to the digital music environment, which allows people very easily to take bits from here or there or chunks from here or there and put them together in new ways. And I guess, although that happens to be a really, really vibrant sphere of activity right now, it also seems to be sort of peculiarly disadvantaged in this environment where the copyright system is such that you know, people are really holding on to the integrity of this recorded thing, and you know, there's just no getting around that. And for a small time artist or somebody who's even looking to benefit from these new niche markets and the long tail effect and being able to find your dispersed audience around the world and deliver content in more of a sort of peer-to-peer way, you're still operating, you're really kind of ducking the radar blip in there because you, what you're doing is not legal, and there's just no easy way to call up Universal and say, hey, I'd like to license this so that I can do whatever with it. And so I still see that as...
I think you're right. You know, and I think that one area where there's a huge opportunity is for our companies to figure out a way to enable us to deal with the small transaction. Mm. Right? You know, you'll enable all the resources of a big company like mine to dealing with a Universal deal or a Microsoft deal. And if you're somebody who wants to use a couple of songs in a particular way, we... You know, we have lots of very expensive people, and it's very hard for us to figure out how to go about doing that in the right way. Mm-hmm. I do think that's something that someday somebody's going to figure out.
Yeah.
You know, it's like eBay figured out how to take, you know, $5 stuff in people's basements and created markets based on that. I do think that one of the things that technology should enable is not doing away with the market, but creating markets that run efficiently at very low cost. Mm-hmm. And that if you could create those markets that run efficiently at very low cost so that, you know, instead of having a lot of transactions that we do by hand at very high cost, we could come up with a lot of transactions that we could do in an automated way. We could enable all these things because ultimately I think they're good for us. Mm-hmm. I think so, it's just hard for us to figure that out.
We did a conference here that I think when you were participant in, was it 2 years ago, called Signal to Noise, in which two camps clearly emerged, at least to my way of thinking. One was the camp of creators with lawyers, and the other was the camp of creators without lawyers. And the creators with lawyers were the people whose creativity had somehow enough already demonstrated commercial value to finance and make it a workable business model, to have a lawyer to negotiate rights and make things legal. And then the large body of people I'd say the dominant body of people who were at the conference, were the creators without lawyers, people who just don't have the money. So far down their priority list with food at the top, that lawyer is way down here. And they're creating music and they're doing stuff. So the idea that somehow they have to deal with a lawsuit or a legal regime and that the burden is on them and all of that just seems extremely frightening.
Mm-hmm.
That's the line of division across which I would love to see some empathy. So do I see empathy?
Oh, you see lots.
For you, for the creators without lawyers, and do I see empathy from you for the companies that deal with the creators with lawyers?
I mean, it's not enough. This isn't enough of an answer. I'll say this is one of the reasons we have empathy. Is one of the organizations we spend a lot of time with is an organization in New York called the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, and we send, and I go, we have a kind of an intake day once a year. We go let people who don't have lawyers and can't afford lawyers come in and talk to our folks, and have them kind of figure out their particular issues. And we see this whole variety of things that never would cross our radar screen otherwise. But you know, the crooked promoter who, took a bunch of CDs and never paid for them, or you know, various others. They sign these contracts that are outrageous and don't know how to get out of them, and all these other kinds of things. That you're nodding your head.
I've heard all kinds of horror stories.
You know all the horror stories. It's a greater societal problem, right? Which is that you study in law school all these rules, and you work them out to the nth degree, and figure out what rules make exact sense, and then you know this. When we want to figure out, we have a dispute with somebody, it costs us millions of dollars to get to a point where we figure out whether those rules are fit. And that's a very nice kind of system that exists in theory that's available to companies that have a lot of money. It's not a system that really provides clarity and certainty and dispute resolution to you know the vast majority of people who need access to a legal system. And it's not just a copyright issue. It's a big societal issue.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I guess it's hard for me to answer directly your question. Do I have empathy for the big companies with lawyers? No, it's hard to find that. I mean, they seem like they're doing all right for themselves, right? And they enable a small group of privileged and sometimes hand-picked artists to fulfill their dreams. But it seems to me that it ends up locking a lot of other things out. And I mean, I look at the contemporary mediascape, and I see a lot of wonderful, promising movements. But I also still see, you know, a fairly monolithic thing, which has its own dynamics of competition and so forth. But still ends up, putting a fairly narrow slice of cultural production in front of huge audiences. And so, you know, I guess I...
Well, let me do my defense of big media, because I do believe that that there is a reason we exist and that it's a good thing. What we do, and what we do really well, is efficiently deliver what large audiences want to see. And, you know, we employ lots and lots of people. There are lots of people who are in this room or elsewhere and your friends who have very interesting, creative, well-paying positions because they're involved in various ways in delivering to large audiences who want to see what we deliver to them and enabling, in some cases creating, in lots of other cases enabling kind of the best and the brightest creators, at least in the sense... say best and brightest, lots of people have different points of view, but at least in the sense of having audiences that really love what they do and helping those artists and their audiences connect with one another and helping them, maximize the return that they get or what they receive from what they do.
Right.
And so, without large companies, there wouldn't be, you know, stuff like, you know, South Park and, you know, Beavis and Butthead, if you will, and... you know, the World Trade Center movie, which cost, you know, $50 million to make, and Mission Impossible 3, which cost, you know, close to $200 million to make.
Right.
And all these big productions, which although, you know, in some ways it's easy to critique, have large audiences, and the mass people, you know, want to see them. And,
right.
and we deliver to those audiences what they want to see.
It's there's a sort of tautology there, though, too, right? I mean, it's a very circular thing. What is it that the audiences want to see? Well, it's what's on TV in front of them. So I don't
yeah,
always
although,
know.
I mean, MTV puts on the order of 50 new premieres a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're
testing the waters.
We're out there. People come with us with ideas. They get their ideas funded. They get their opportunity to make something, and they get the opportunity to see if it finds an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Of that, probably 48 of them don't.
Right.
And so it's very much the audience that's deciding what's going to be successful. Now, is that done in part through a lens of, you know, a wide variety of people inside our company that, you know, kind of have a point of view as to what's going to resonate with the audience? Yeah, but if they get it wrong, you know, Fox will figure it out, or NBC will figure it out, or Time Warner, you know, or Fuse, you know, which is a smaller cable channel, will figure it out. They have to connect with that audience every day, or the market. And this is an area where the market's very competitive, you know, in television programming.
Uh-huh.
You know, people will just not watch. I mean, what made The Sopranos successful was not marketing The Sopranos. It was the fact that people watched it and stayed with it because they really enjoyed the product. And so I feel like what we're doing is, in very way, many ways, a very democratic thing,
right?
Which is that consumers for, you know, $4 or $10 it takes to go to a movie or whatever are voting and deciding what it is they want to see. And I'll tell you, it's hard. You know, it's not, no amount of marketing, no machine will get people to plunk down their $10 and go to a movie if it's not the movie they want to see.
Uh-huh.
You know, and for whatever we may think as critics of Borat, you know, it just did, you know, $50 million in the box office its first two weekends, and, you know, the consumers have voted that that's what they want to see. So I think that's a very good thing in kind of delivering to people what they want.
So now I'd like to open this up, if I may. To Becca, to Mark Morrell, whom I'll introduce in a moment, to Brett Talley, John Lobato, and Nick Rose, who did the week's page this week, and then to everyone else. So, Rebecca, would you lead off in any way?
Well, there's a couple of things that we didn't get to that I was interested in here. One of the things that seems like, so it seems like basically there's some potential common ground for a system that is less lawyer-mediated, where people can directly access the things that they want to license and have some way of licensing them. And we could all sort of agree on some system that could make that possible. But I'm still concerned about things that may be out of reach for being licensed, and that where your reason for using them. Well, I guess I'd like you to show the mashup example that you've got, because it's a Jay-Z mashup, so that's like, you know, up there as far as what you'd have to pay to use this, and is making a critical statement about that music that mm-hmm. you can explain.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem clear to me that it would be acceptable to you if you had to say, okay, I can license this from Jay-Z if the people who then want to hear it pay $15 in order to hear the mashup that I've made.
Right. And maybe it should be able to exist anyway. Or
yeah, and maybe it should be able to exist anyway. I don't know. That's the question I would like to see discussed.
Yeah, and we'll see to what extent this raises it. This is one of these so-called pedagogical mashups that I make. This is a mashup of Jay-Z's Big Pimpin', which surely many of you know. How many of you have heard Big Pimpin'? Yes, right. It was a big song, right? 1999, I think it came out, and it was a huge hit, a global hit. And one of the reasons I decided to mash it up, and one of the kinds of mashups I make, is where you take two songs that have some sort of musical relationship and put them together to underscore that relationship. In this case, I put together Jay-Z's Big Pimpin', which let me just play you a snippet of, so for those who haven't heard it, you'll recognize it. This is the sort of main riff of Big Pimpin'. Okay, and that well-known riff is, you know, a two-measure musical statement that Timbaland, the producer, either replayed himself or had a studio hand replayed. It's not a direct sample, but it's clearly a replayed portion from a mid a mid-20th century Egyptian pop song called Khosara by Abdul Halim Hafez, which goes like this. It's fairly recognizable, right? I mean, it's a no-brainer that they're put together. And I found an article written in an Egyptian newspaper which was discussing the question here of, in fact, copyright, because from at least according to this article, there was no suit instigated by whoever owns the rights to this song, which I think is no longer the composer or the singer, but a record label owner, because it was replayed and it's a small portion, and there were all these legal issues about whether or not it could constitute an infringing use. Although the record label owner did add that, because he changed the composition, he wouldn't have given him permission to use it. So there's that sort of moral rights thing getting in there as well, that, you know, derivative uses are out of the question at any rate. And another interesting thing about the fact that it had an Egyptian identity that was somewhat suppressed is that representations of it in journalistic journalistic press often referred to it with a sort of wild variety of Orientalist signifiers. So they didn't necessarily name it as Egyptian. They would say it's Bollywood tinged, or it's Balinese. And I mean, they've come up with all sorts of ways of sort of trying to make sense of these exotic sounds, which Timbaland did a great job of harnessing. So on the one hand, I wanted to put them together to call attention to that relationship and raise some of those issues. And then also some of the resonance that comes out of the fact that it's a Jay-Z song that's extolling pimpin', and not in the metaphorical pimp the system, it's a hustle sort of thing, but in the non-metaphorical pimp a woman, make some money for you and maybe a little bit for her sort of thing. So as typical mashups go, you'd do this A plus B thing. Okay, I'll take the Egyptian version, we'll let that play out, then I'll bring in the Jay-Z version, then I'll bring in the Egyptian version again. And I couldn't find any Jay-Z verses, despite being quite a hip-hop fan myself, that I really wanted to let play out, because I found them, fairly offensive. So I did this somewhat more creative thing where I chopped up I basically just tried to save the good words, which were rather few. So in cases where he'd say, love 'em, leave 'em, I just sort of took out the leave 'em and repeat the love 'em. So he says, love 'em, love 'em, love 'em. And then he says things like, take him out the hood, keep him looking good, which is, still kind of problematic in its own way. And then he says something like, you could be living it up. Again, the good life, is it a materialistic statement or not? But another thing that I liked when I put it together then with this Abdul Halim Hafez song is, phrases like, take him out the hood, keep him looking good, against this explicitly sort of Middle Eastern thing, had these other resonances to me, right? Is it a critique of the veil? Is it the Jack Straw, taking him out the hood, keep him looking good sort of line? Or is it a critique of Abu Ghraib, take him out the hood, keep him looking good, let's end sort of those sort of policies? So I like that it assumed all this extra resonance by putting them together. So not only did it have this sort of critical intent of putting together this song that was that had a contentious relationship in terms of, I guess, compositional rights, but that could serve a broader sort of and suggestive critical purpose. So let me just play a little bit for you, and you guys can decide for yourselves. What we have is a couple bars of the Halim Hafez, at which point I bring in the Jay-Z over it, and then this longer chunk is the verse. So we get to hear Abdul Halim Hafez sing his verse, which is, I guess it's sort of a sorrowful song. I put it up on the internet and I got all sorts of comments, some of which said, oh yes, he's weeping about his neighbor having left, and so it has this other resonance on top. Other people saying, Egyptians are the best, Jay-Z sucks. and other people saying things like, thank you, good sir, you melted my mind. So I sort of like that big mix of things too, and I like that as a sort of public document on it. Let me play it for you, and I'll play it up till we get to the first sort of rapid cuts and edits of Jay-Z, so you can hear my sort of my dubbed out remix of his pimp lyrics. The original gets augmented by Timbaland's 8 now. Oh, another thing I should do that I'll mention, coming up here, up here, the original song modulates. It sort of changes chords. It moves around musically in a way that the Jay-Z does not. So what I had to do in that case was take a little clip of the Jay-Z and pitch it up 5 semitones, sort of to make it follow it around. And what I liked about that gesture is that it seemed like I was sort of disciplining the new version to the original. So to some extent, actually paying tribute to the integrity of the original. Jay-Z, Timbaland, all those people, which I do in my blog post. But maybe to come back to your point, first of all, the Egyptian guys would not let me license this because they didn't want to let Jay-Z license it. To license it from Jay-Z would presumably be a rather costly endeavor. And this thing, I guess, in the current legal environment, wouldn't exist without me just deciding to do it and put it out there.
What did Jay-Z do?
What did Jay-Z do?
Did he license it from the Egyptians?
No, there was none of that done because, you know, and I don't know how far this went in sort of legal proceedings, but I think...
So he's taken a much bigger risk than you were.
Sure. Yeah,
you know,
I guess.
Because there was real money there. I mean, you know, from...
Because he made a lot of money on that song.
He made a lot of money on that song, and it's, right. You know, and that was a direct, you know, use of the product in a very big commercial way.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, obviously this gets into very sort of legal distinctions between what constitutes an original portion of the work and, you know, how much of a portion does it have to be of that work versus the new work, and it was replayed as opposed to directly sampled, so then it's not even getting into the mechanical rights, it's a publishing rights thing, and if the composer's...
Right, and I those issues are really hard, and they're hard for us too. We have a hard time grappling with them. I mean, from our perspective... The thing that we spend our nights and days worrying about are not even these issues. It's the exact copy finding its way around the world. It's people watching the show or watching the whole movie or taking the bit out of a television show so that people don't have to watch the television show and kind of evade the model. And, you know, frankly, in the world of television, copies get made all the time in the sense of, you know, stuff gets rehashed. You know, we created Survivor. We actually did litigate that issue with... ABC on something called Get Me Out of Here, and didn't prevail in that particular case despite the fact they took huge elements of the show. But in television, you know, these things come in waves. And I actually remember, you know, listening to somebody who studies the television business talking about how, you know, in the 50s there were sitcoms, and then, you know, people got bored of sitcoms, so they started doing sitcoms that were the same show but with goofy themes like, you know, monsters and Stone Age Men and the Flintstones and all that, and then that evolved. And, you know, reality television now is probably, you know, in a serious way 10 years old, and it's morphed and modulated. And basically people took those ideas and People understood that those ideas were being taken. They were there for the taking. People didn't copy the whole show beginning to end. They took the idea and took it in some other direction. It seems to me that a system that's functioning well should allow people to take the idea and move it in a different direction, and should prevent the people who want to just take the exact copy and add nothing to it. You've added a tremendous amount of creativity to this, and frankly, both your creativity, it should enable you to avoid somebody just taking this exactly and saying it's theirs, or making a lot of money on it and not compensating you for what you did and your creativity and your time and effort. And at the same time, should allow a perfect system would allow you to do that, and not, you know, make it impossible to get those rights. From the point of view of the cost of licensing Jay-Z, at least the way my company would think about it, is for somebody who's going to have a relatively small audience, if the cost is too high, then we make nothing, right? I mean, so the way the market ought to work is if somebody is going to make 50 copies, I shouldn't charge a price for those 50 copies that says the transaction doesn't happen at all, because then nobody wins. So again, we have this transaction cost problem, which is, you know, Jay-Z should love to license this to you for a small amount of money representing the audience. And he comes out better and you come out better. The problem to me is that we still haven't figured out how to evolve that system that enables that transaction to take place in an efficient way.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly something that hip-hop producers have been calling for a long time, which is give me a menu so I know how I can sample it and how much it'll cost me and that sort of thing. And that still ends up being rather constraining in its own way, because certain works, like Public Enemies, you know, late 80s productions are just inconceivable. They're just impossible because there are too many samples going on and too dense and that sort of thing. But is this getting away from your...
No, it's right on it. There's just two parts of it that I feel like I want to hear more about. One of them is the moral rights thing that we keep coming up against, that it's possible Jay-Z does not want this to be licensed, and it's clear that this company that owns the Egyptian version does not want it licensed, and it seems like you're basically wanting to say, I should be able to do this because it's something worth saying, regardless of whether the artist actually wants me to or not. And I don't know if there's any sense of... right this moment? Yeah, I'll finish my question. If there's any sense of some way that we could really start doing it automatically and that the artists and creators might take a step back from that position. And the other thing, well, let's take a break and we'll just do that question.
Okay.
Tape change. Is there another mic, or we just did this way?
We just did this, so we're happy to call. All right, so we're going again. That was the thing I was curious about.
Well, you know, the moral rights issue is, first of all, legally, it's much less a U.S. issue than it is an international issue. Internationally, European law has traditionally said that when an artist creates something, they have an intrinsic right that's embodied in their copyright laws to keep somebody from transforming it in a way that's inconsistent with the desires of the artist. That bangs head on. It's not a big business issue. Frankly, my company would rather not see moral rights around than it is an artist-driven issue kind of from a European sensibility.
Let me just clarify a little. I didn't mean to get just into the legal concept of moral rights, but just in this idea that the artist would selectively control who gets to use a sample or not, which is something that exists under the U.S. copyright system.
True. And I think there... and maybe it's not always perfect, but there's the whole concept of fair use under the copyright law. And if you want to use the use for academic teaching purposes and want to use a clip of something to illustrate something, want to talk about the lyrics by using something that's less than the whole work and isn't going to really affect the market for the work, in the sense that, you know, nobody's going to buy this when they want the Jay-Z song.
Or
the other song, for that matter. And in that way, it doesn't really diminish the market for the Jay-Z song in any way. Mm-hmm. The fundamental principles of fair use, it kind of hits it head on. It's what the balance of copyright law hasn't quite got there, but the intent is right, and I think we ought to keep tinkering with what the fair use rights are. I think we should be able to allow people to, certainly to comment and criticize in an academic way.
Right.
Well, so let me speak from the maybe slightly hypothetical perspective of the worried wife, where he's putting this stuff out there, and it's illegal. on the face of it, and perhaps there's a fair use argument that he can make, but that's a defense that he's got. So he's going to, you know, get sued and then have to mount a defense, and we don't have a lawyer, and it's our, it, you know, every asset that we have is on the line when he puts this thing out there.
I hear you.
Is this every asset of her father.
is it a commercial use in the sense, are you, you know, selling copies of this?
Well, no, but obviously that can be a slippery slope too, right? Because somebody might look at, well, he's getting booked to play gigs here and there, so there's a, you know, down the line sort of commercial benefit that he gets to promoting himself using.
Right. Although the discos will have performance rights. Licenses from ASCAP and BMI, so the composers of the song will get compensated, actually, by virtue of the
license. If I perform it in the disco. But if this is just about promoting me as an artist, then, well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it gets into these...
I think there's theory, and I think there's reality. I honestly can't imagine, all the dealings I've had as general counsel of a copyright company, imagine anybody wanting to take the position on something like this that have violated our copyrights.
Right. And I obviously take great pains to make clear my transformative, you know, the, what I've done to transform something, what I think is the critical intent, and to sort of explicate all that. I guess I end up being more concerned for the less academically trained artist who's out there trying to justify what they're doing, and which maybe you still might see as having, as serving a purpose of commentary in the popular cultural world. You might just take an Eminem song and a Britney Spears song and put them together to illustrate something like maybe that they're a lot closer together than Eminem would have them be. And, you know, that's a fairly subtle point maybe, and maybe somebody looking at it representing either of those parties would say, well, yeah, we don't really see why that should be a fair defense.
Let me bring Mark into this. Mark, just tell us who you are.
I'm Mike's colleague at Viacom. I'm the deputy general counsel, and I've also worked in the copyright area for a number of years, starting in book publishing at Simon & Schuster, and more recently in our television and motion picture business.
And more importantly, the father of a 3L here at Harvard Law School.
Father of a 3L, Dan Harrell, some of you may know.
Do you feel empathy for Wayne's position?
Well, I do, and I think it's emerged in the discussion. I think the practical reality is that no one's going after Wayne or Wayne's World, to use a pun, of social commentary, short excerpts, transformative use, not commercial. You know, Wayne is worried because he's an academic. He understands the issues. He lives in a Harvard Law School family. But the reality is that I think there is, you know, your conduct is not even at the margin of legality. I think it's very squarely fair use. There's been some interesting litigation in the motion picture industry. Again, the Directors Guild, not the studios, brought a case against a company called CleanFlix. CleanFlix is based in Utah, and they were in the business of editing out what they thought were offensive scenes and offensive language in motion pictures. I think the most notorious one was the love scene in Titanic was edited out. And they actually, Congress got involved, the motion picture studios got involved in starting to release the airline versions, the edited versions of the motion pictures, but that was a kind of fair use collides with moral rights.
I also say this, though, to
issue.
The nervous wife. Yeah. People talk to these people and would have accepted them not doing the service, but long before they were interested in any money out of this. So, and in fact, in all the lawsuits that there have been, where, you know, there's a period of time where really initiated before Rockstar, where we're kind of trying to go after end users who are just uploading massive amounts of non-transformative, you know, here's the song. They're always preceded by a letter, there's a problem, we want to kind of figure out a way to deal with this before, you know, there's a litigation. There's you know, no circumstance where something like this would really be a problem.
A cease and desist notice.
You're
right. Yeah, so I'm not so worried about the cease and desist, but I am worried about also us having some money for us to live on, and it seems like the premise of this is that he has to not earn money off of this. If what he's doing is really something that people want, and it is artistic and creative and not replacing the original work, why shouldn't he be able to earn money off of it?
He should, but there, I think there's a whole organization of people who are in the business to license this stuff who would make licenses available. I mean, and the same, that he should be able to earn money and not have somebody make an infinite number of copies of what he did for free and, you know, take away his right to earn a living.
So, passing back to our week's crew here. John, Brett.
Just taking sort of the long-term view of this battle, when the NAFTA litigation began, there was a lot of speculation that, you know, this could be the death of the music industry. And with, you know, as computers get faster and internet connections develop, it becomes easier and easier for artists to get their work out without having to go through the middleman, as it were. So for both of you, you know, where do you see this ending? Do you think, can copyright be changed enough to sort of harness this, you know, radically new technology, or is it going to be a brand new world, as it were?
Both. I mean, I see the powers and the interests and resources behind copyright continuing to find ways to adapt, whether that is to sort of, you know, hit at the flashpoints, as well as to develop their own products and technologies that seem to embrace some of the very same technologies that are enabling these infringing uses. I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that the celestial jukebox, which was a very theoretical proposition 5-10 years ago, is soon to be here, and it's going to require, I guess, a lot of very convoluted sort of negotiations among those who own the major rights. I guess the other thing I might introduce here is that there's a sort of often unexamined assumption on the part of the major media content holders, the MPAA, the RIAA, that they represent the majority of artists, which, again, in this emerging democratized field of production, is no longer true. I mean, there are a lot more people making music, maybe not so much movies. There are a lot more people recording music not represented by these organizations than represented by them, and finding new ways, whether that's through CD Baby or whether that's through other forms of sort of peer-to-peer exchange, or even finding a way into iTunes, which is possible too, to get their music out there. So I don't know. I guess I still see two parallel, competing, sometimes overlapping streams going.
I see many, many threads. And I think that they're going to constantly be changing and evolving and competing and making peace. And I do think that the big companies are going to go where the money is, which means that there will be a thriving community of people who are, you know, not where significant dollars are, and aren't going after these, you know, just the pure copy stuff, where it will, just as a matter of economics, it's not because of the expense of the legal system, because of the expense of enforcement, that people just aren't going to go after it, and that the world will ultimately adapt, that that's a way of doing business. And whatever the legal rules are, I think in any industry, in every part of the legal system, you'll see people who have adapted to a set of conventions about how they operate, that people would find very surprising if they deviated from those conventions, even though the legal system may not be in that same place. And I think this world is going to very clearly exist in a series of worlds, a place where, regardless of what the copyright law says, it's never going to be established by the courts because people aren't going to go there. And the world will just, you know, coexist on that particular issue. But I also think that the digital technologies have enabled such a rapid amount of innovation and change that there are going to be lots and lots of copyright issues where there are going to be differing points of view on those issues. And when I say it's multiple threads, I said we're a user, we're a licensor, we're a licensee, we take other people's ideas and put them in our television shows. We create ideas that other people take in their television shows. We have artists in our company. We have artists that are very important relationships to our company. We have creative people in our company, and we have business people in our company, and all those interests kind of come together. And so we're not a monolith on any of these issues. I mean, we had a huge set debates internally to the company on the question about whether we should send takedown notices to YouTube on our content. And it's clearly infringing stuff that's sitting up there on YouTube. And this isn't a question of whether we litigate it and bring in the lawyers. It's a question about whether we send them a letter that says, please take it down. And they're taking it down. And yet, you know, there's a whole thread of thought about our users are putting it up there. Do you want to interfere with something that our users want to do? And the whole thread that talks about the fact that ultimately the future of the company is going to involve in licensing this stuff. And can you allow, you know, a very big company that just sold for $1.6 billion, so you're clearly making money on it, to take all this kind of, you know, real just pure copied stuff and post it and then make money on it and not compensate us for that? So in short, I think the answers are in some ways not going to be obvious answers. And I think that thinking about it as kind of just left and right is really an oversimplification. It's much more intricate than that.
Mike and Mark, thank you both very much for coming.
This was fun. Thank you for inviting us.
It's a pleasure. And I hope we continue to relate and work on this long tail thing. I like it very much.
All right. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you.
Really appreciate it. Enjoy
meeting you. Thanks.
So pardon me for not walking up with you. John? Nick?
Thanks.
Yeah, I guess this works out perfectly. My questions are actually for Wayne. So the one thing we were discussing that Rebecca mentioned is sort of this, how you could use this mashing up of songs. So in a situation where, let's say, we developed a compulsory licensing system where you have to, you're allowed to use these songs, but you have to pay a fee to use them, do you think that that's an adequate solution, or would most people still say that their use should be allowed even absent this compulsory license?
Well, I'm not sure that I can say what most people would say necessarily. I mean, I think a lot of it sort of might be better conceived as along a sliding scale. You know, certain people are in a position, say, if they're at Viacom, to license something from Universal, you know, at a fairly high price. Other people are just starting out, or you know, just not in a terribly commercial venture to begin with, and so are not in a position to do that at all. And then there are some people, as you say, who might just take a sort of militant position on it and say, no, this is commercial culture. I'm doing something that is that runs oppositional to that, or runs critical to that, and I don't really see any need to participate in it. I mean, that's going to continue to happen too.
I guess that ties into another point, which is in arguing for more openness or less restrictions on the copyright system, how far does that go? I mean, it's obviously some sort of sliding scale, like you were saying, but there has to be a point at which we're going to say either let's stop here and enforce the copyrights and the creator's ownership interest in the work, or we're going to go to the far extreme. And where you choose that line seems like a balance of interest that, I mean, one person may be no better to judge than another person.
Yeah, I mean, that's where we come into the court of public opinion, right? Because that's sort of where it has to be ultimately determined. What is a use that seems fair? What is a use that seems critical? What's a use that seems too commercial or, you know, too bound up with that?
Well, one of the things that's of interest to me, particularly in talking with Mike about what he sees as possible lines of development here, is the connection between his thought and the core thought of the Creative Commons approach. In a sense, Creative Commons is like a court of public opinion approach, because it moves the locus of decision from the overarching policy of how are we going to work this out, looking at it from the top, down to a strategy of putting in the hands of the creator a wide array of possible ways of controlling what they want to do and letting the creator choose. And right now what Mike is saying is the creators really don't have that much choice. Even Creative Commons doesn't offer the choice of some kind of mechanized license system where you pay a very small amount
on Wayne's hip-hop schedule and click a box and not have to write letters and not have trouble finding out and all that kind of stuff. But one could see an approach elaborating the choice at individual level that would in some way mitigate the problem without your having to go through Congress or without your having to go to the top to get to your solution.
I'm not sure what I would say in response to that, but I think that does in some senses exist on Creative Commons, that the choice is left to the individual creator. But in doing so, you're eliminating these middlemen, which could be the record companies, the RIAA or the MPAA, whoever. And in making that affirmative choice to eliminate them, you may have to contract around that if you ever want to go through them, too. So in essence, you're stuck back at the same place, because let's say you're an individual artist who chose at the beginning to engage in this Creative Commons licensing and give away your things for, let's say, share-alike attribution, something like that. Well, when you wanted to make a profit from your activities or you wanted to engage in wide-scale distribution that record labels are able to do or engage in, then to a certain extent, they wouldn't want you giving away your music to those for attribution fees, or, I mean, they want their piece of the pie, too, as a middle person for engaging in their own activity. So I think that's definitely reasonable at the level where you say it's just an individual creator who is setting something out in the marketplace and doing it themselves, but it's harder to see how that would work in a system where you have to, where distribution may be better served for your own economic purposes when it's in record stores, on iTunes, and it goes through all these other mediums. I mean, there are definitely ways to get it out there other than going through record labels. There's no question about that. But still, it seems that is the traditional way right now. And until that really changes, the Creative Commons approach may not be fully fulfilled.
Nick, you want a shot?
Well, actually,
grab the mic.
I had a different question, because one of the things that was resonating with me was just about kind of the uncertainty for your average individual that we're looking to kind of get creativity out of. And it seems like no matter what we decide, you're going to have that kind of weird transition where, you know, you're potentially in for a long period of time where no one's going to know really what they can do at all. And even under a system that might be, I guess my question is, how do you even start a transition? Because even if we can see a good end goal for years, I could imagine a system where everyone's just kind of in this weird limbo and not knowing if they're going to get, you know, a knock on the door, and not knowing if you're going to all of a sudden, it probably wouldn't go that far. But
or a cease and desist in the mail.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. It seems to require an awful lot of centralization to me. I mean, and that's the sort of the problem with the Terry Fisher proposal, too. I mean, it requires a full transparency of knowledge and agreement by all parties to participate in this sort of thing, too. So I don't know. I mean, I guess we've gotten to the present state by a form of sort of willy-nilly coercion, and maybe we'll get there that way, too. But it seems awfully complicated.
I have a question for you, Wayne.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else on your computer that was so interesting? I'd love to see an encore of some kind. Have you got anything to offer?
Oh, do I even have that? I don't know. It's a new computer, so I'm afraid I don't have all that much on here at the moment. Including, well, the other one that I do have on here is a sort of similar idea. I call it The Lion Seeps Tonight. And it's a mashup of four different versions of the song probably most of us know as The Lion Sleeps Tonight by The Tokens.
Is that Weemaway?
That's Weemaway, which was the recording by the Weavers in 1951, but it's actually Mbube, which was a recording by Solomon Linda and his Evening Birds, recorded in 1939 in South Africa. And it's a very convoluted story about appropriation and to some extent, I guess I'd say very underhanded assertion of copyright. I mean, there was a story, an expose written for Rolling Stone magazine by the guy whose name is escaping me at the moment. But if you Google Lion Seeps tonight, you'll find my page at Rhythm Method where I've posted this mashup and linked to some of these sources. But, you know, essentially, Pete Seeger ends up getting some degree of copyright over this, and it ends up in the hands of some publishing guys who trade it around themselves. And, you know, by this point, this song is a huge song, right? It was included in the Disney's Lion King, which became a huge Broadway show. And, I mean, it's the estimates that this guy who wrote the expose was getting was that, oh, maybe it's generated, you know, $15 million or something like that over its lifetime. And, you know, Solomon Linda, you know, died in a shack sleeping on, you know, a bed of cow dung to soften the floor, basically. You know, and so it's got a lot of tragedy to it. And I sort of wanted to get at some of that in a very embodied audio kind of way. And I also wanted to do some of these creative critical moves, too, where, again, for instance, as you can see, I've got the original song at the top here, uncut. You don't see any of these lines through it. It's the whole full song. So I'm letting that sort of determine the composition. And then I've got these other ones that I've, in some cases, changed tempo and pitch and so forth so that they end up, again, in a sense, disciplined to the original. But also what emerges is a lot of dissonance. I mean, this is a soupy kind of thing. By the time we get to the fourth version, and Ima Sumac, her version begins in a related key, and so it's kind of consonant and then kind of not so consonant. I mean, I feel like the mashup embodies a lot of the dissonance of the story itself. And what's also nice is you can really hear the musical thread throughout them and how the composition, the original composition, despite other people asserting their right over it, does have a kind of integrity that shines through them all. So I'll play this one, and we can see maybe what issues it raises. But you'll hear in the beginning some very familiar sounds. Comes the Weavers. And they sort of hoke it up a little bit. And then here comes Ima Sumac. Anybody know Ima Sumac? Operatic, sort of kitschy exotica singer from the 60s, 50s. So she's that higher voice that comes in. It's sort of building layers. About to get some brass band activity. And here we have the Tokens organ solo, which you'll all recognize, I'm sure. It's, you know, getting a little bit dissonant. There's a lot going on.
I feel like we should end class at this point and everybody should go out with the music, you know.
And we get these two brassy chords to finish it. I thought it was pretty funny that the Weavers song and the Ima Sumac both end with that big brassy chord, but I mean, obviously for anybody to argue that this is going to compete in the marketplace for any of these four versions is crazy. But thanks for listening.
All right, so can we say thanks to Wayne?
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow we're going to do workshop on podcasts. We're going to play a lot of podcasts. We're going to talk about them. So see you all tomorrow.
If you want to hear me play lots of other people's music tonight, enormous room, 10 p.m.
Right on the tee.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.